Malcolm X and James Baldwin Changed Me by Max Farrer. I can still feel the shock as a febrile teenager at a boarding school in the mid-1960s when my friend revealed to me that he was black and was subjected to racism during the school holidays. We plunged into newspaper accounts of the civil rights struggle in the USA and up popped James Baldwin's 1956 novel, Giovanni's Room. There began my lifetime's campaign for equality, whatever your race, class, gender or sexuality. It was a short step to Baldwin's other novels, and then his essays propelled me towards the Black Power branch of the civil rights movement. We gobbled up Alex Haley's riveting biography of Malcolm X in the 1968 Penguin edition, and we thought we should join the armed wing of the African National Congress after we graduated. Many years later, one of our grandkids pulled Baldwin's 1962 essays, The Fire Next Time, from our bookshelves, and I took that as a sign that I should reread it. I reapplied that reading about Elijah Muhammad through Baldwin's surprisingly sympathetic eyes, and realised that it had prepared me for Malcolm Little's conversion to the Nation of Islam, just as Alex Haley's carefully curated book prepared me for his subsequent break from them. As a bookish undergraduate browsing Pelican originals in the 1960s, I found E.U. Essien Udom's thoroughly researched book about the Nation of Islam, and that showed me the nation's main enthusiasm was for capitalism with a black face. And of course it reinforced Malcolm's expose of its mumbo jumbo and its utterly bogus version of Islam. It was fitting now, this year, that we're celebrating the centenaries of both Malcolm and Baldwin, that I should read for the first time Baldwin's 1961 debate with Malcolm. It brought home to me how prescient Baldwin was in asking us to think about the consequences of the racial violence that he and Malcolm both saw as inevitable and imminent. He acutely questioned Malcolm's masculinist call for black Americans to fight like men, and he gently rejected theology of all types. And more than 60 years ago, there was Baldwin clearly opposing the racialized essentialism that underpinned Malcolm's black nationalism. Recently rereading chunks of the autobiography, I found myself more gripped by his early life than I was by his life in the nation. In his excellent foreword, Haley hints that, as Malcolm was perpetually genuflecting to Wallace Fard Muhammad, there was a bad smell in the air. The book's account of Malcolm's conversion at Mecca is a consummate example of how learning from experience is often far more significant than learning from oratory and books. Browsing yet again The Fire Next Time has helped me understand why I prefer the little boy and the hustler Malcolm to the Nation of Islam's Malcolm. I had thought it was because I couldn't take reading about myself as a white devil, because this reminded me of actually being called a white devil in Chapeltown, Leeds in the 1970s. Nowadays, when somebody kindly calls me an ally, I know it was my school friend, plus Jimmy Baldwin and Malcolm X, who put me on that path. There's one bit from Baldwin's reflections on the self-proclaimed Elijah Muhammad, which actually includes some good words about Malcolm, that showed me what had really grabbed me about the young Malcolm. It's the bit where Baldwin was listening to the blues. He highlighted Big Bill Brunsey's songs. This is a sideline, but as it happens, I'd absorbed Brunsey in the mid-1960s because a fellow pupil brought in his records from Brian Epstein's shop in Liverpool. Our posse admired Epstein not just for managing the Beatles, but for being expelled from the school that we hated. Baldwin said that white Americans, and surely this goes for us white English too, do not understand the ironic tenacity revealed in blues songs, because they are terrified of the sensuality that underlies it. Being sensual, he wrote, involves respecting and rejoicing in the force of life itself, and being present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. This, for me, so many years later, is why the first half of the autobiography remains so compelling. Quite rightly, Malcolm has no shame in his past, which he narrated perhaps to heighten his credibility among the black working class, as well as to provide a cautionary tale. What I find more striking, however, is the pure force of his nefarious life, as he tells it. He vividly recalls episodes, even when his body is suffused with industrial quantities of booze, coke, and weed, because he is so utterly and admirably present throughout. Another sideline is that I wasn't too impressed with Spike Lee's film of Haley's book, partly because it glamorized what Malcolm had described in its mercenary banality, and partly because it lacked the sensuality you feel in the book. Anyway, the autobiography lived on for me for another reason. In the 1980s, I began to hear from Chapeltown's young men and women of Caribbean heritage about their conversion to Islam. They were elated and inspired by shedding their Christian upbringing and finding at last something they experienced as a true faith. These sincere young people tried to draw me in, but I was too committed to Marx's idea that religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature and the heart of the heartless world. And I had adopted the response that Marx advocated. Nevertheless, I thought it was a significant moment in the story of Black Britain, and I tried and failed to get the story published. When in 2005, three men of South Asian and one of Caribbean descent bombed London in the name of Allah, I researched political Islam, and the absence of Malcolm X was glaring. Instead, Al-Qaeda had totally distorted a potentially radical religion and developed a strategy gleaned from the violent strands in Western revolutionary praxis. Its agents had drilled an ideology far worse than the nation's into the minds of these three young men from Leeds and one from Huddersfield. Had the nation and the FBI not killed Malcolm, Osama bin Laden might not have gained such prominence. Malcolm's Organization of African American Unity, utilizing Sunni Islam, might have made such a difference. Malcolm's legacy remains disputed. YNK insisted Malcolm's true political philosophy is for jihad, correctly translated as struggle, for self-determination, based on the precepts laid down by the actual Prophet Muhammad, by which K means an autonomous American state for African Americans. George Brightman, on the other hand, claimed that in the last year of his life, Malcolm became a, quote, black nationalist plus social revolutionist, and then was beginning to doubt the nationalist part. He provided evidence, including a late interview Malcolm did with the American Young Socialist magazine, where he predicted the collapse of capitalism and praised the young white radicals he'd recently met. I'm most persuaded, however, by the words of Malcolm's daughter, Ilyasa Shabazz. In her autobiography, she positioned herself as a much-loved child in a, quote, mainstream and privileged and integrated and utterly American home. A beautiful young Muslim who learnt to hustle, as she puts it, in clubs in Mount Vernon, the Bronx and White Plains. By hustle, she means disco dance, and her term holds no irony. While her story is more a praise song for her mother than an appraisal of her dad, she's very clear that Malcolm's by any means necessary strategy forever impressed in my mind as the poster where he holds an M1 carbine, is not a call to violence, but a commitment to self-defence alongside a comprehensive set of tactics for redressing the systemic oppression and exploitation of African Americans. The implication throughout, stemming from her mother's own climb to academic seniority and her father's continuous self-education, which started long before his time in prison and never stopped, is that education is a major component of those tactics. There's also a hint of economic nationalism where she adds a clarion call for the expansion of black-owned businesses, but the cornerstones of Malcolm's strategy, she says, are an accurate understanding of world history and a new colourblind humanism. These will eradicate self-loathing and instill self-respect among African Americans, Shabazz argues. And of course, that would change white people too, just as Jimmy and Malcolm have changed me.